The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Establishment people.
God almighty, why would I be for Trump? He's a jerk, and he's a liberal.
Tell me what you got here.
Okay, so I'm selling the buttons. I have ones that say, Vote Trump 2016, Let's Make America Great Again, Trump for President, Bomb the Hell Out of ISIS.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. New Hampshire's twisted distortion of democracy is about to end. And all of those campaign commercial and appearance-saturated voters will get to make a choice that will end this opening chapter of the 2016 race for the White House. New Hampshire voters will be ending the campaigns of some candidates and rejuvenating some others. If New Hampshireites are so inclined, they can deliver significant momentum to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. They can build on the momentum of Senator Ted Cruz from Iowa and Hillary Clinton, who won Iowa by a hair. Or they can completely reshuffle the deck. And in the past, New Hampshireites have done all of those. The power of New Hampshire this hour to clarify or obfuscate an already hazy field of candidates. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, is in Concord, New Hampshire. Todd, a lot of anticipation there for tomorrow's voting. Everyone's in town. Everyone's in the state anyway.
Yeah, John, everyone's crisscrossing the state, and today primarily the southern part of the state where the people are conquered. Nashua, Manchester, of course, that's where the bulk of the voters are, and that's where the campaign buses are crisscrossing all day. Now, weather may be a factor here. You say, well, New Hampshire doesn't get buried in the snow, and they don't, but 5 to 8 inches expected over today and into tonight. There is a concern that that could keep some older voters at home and not at the polls, and if you're Hillary Clinton in particular, that could be a big problem. She's relying on a surge from older voters who know her, who trust her, who's familiar with her, to counteract a surge of Bernie Sanders among young voters. And he's expecting a big one. Let me play you a little bit of audio, if I can, from a voter I ran into at a Bernie rally just yesterday, who gave me a sense of why Bernie is so popular with young people. He's Philip McHenry. He's 22 from the University of New Hampshire.
There's something about him, even though he's not perfect, he's kind of raw. And I think that's why so many people are coming out and standing up for this guy. You can tell he's a human being. You know, he goes home and does what the average American seems to do. Hillary might do the same thing, but it's covered up. You know, she's very much like a front for the media, it almost seems like, you know.
Normal American, except he was on Saturday Night Live this weekend. It was a little abnormal weekend for Bernie Sanders.
Sure. And so part of the charge then on Bernie Sanders is whether being the outsider and then being a front runner in a place like New Hampshire, in fact, makes you an insider. Now, Bernie Sanders up by double digits in the polls here, just like Donald Trump. So it's going to be very, very hard, of course, for Hillary Clinton to put up a win here. The Clinton campaign is really looking forward to South Carolina and Nevada, where she's probably going to make a much stronger showing in Nevada. Of course, the culinary workers unions and other workers probably strongly for Hillary, and the first large swath of minority and African-American voters in this race so far in South Carolina. So don't expect a huge showing from Hillary here, although they're already looking over the horizon to Nevada, South Carolina, and other states, John.
What about Donald Trump? I mean, he's managed to keep a persistent double-digit lead in these closing weeks.
And there has been nothing that's put a dent in that. It's been quite remarkable. A very, you know, a disappointing performance for Trump in Iowa, and then crisscrossing New Hampshire, not quite as bombastic as he has been. But I've talked to a number of Trump voters from all across that, mostly younger people, but some older folks too. And let me play you some younger voters who were excited about Donald Trump. Here's Kaffa Cody. She's 24. She's an activist. She's from Londonderry. She's a chemistry student. And she's explaining why she's for Trump, even though some of his campaign, she admits, it's, you know, can be a bit ugly.
I can tell you, people aren't happy. People are mad about what's been going on. People don't like the fact that there aren't jobs. I have a lot of friends who are going to get degrees who I don't know if they're going to have jobs. People are mad about the way things are going. And so I think that he's tapping into that says that, and I think he's showing that people aren't really happy about it. So some of the stuff he says might come off that way, but I think if you look past it, you see that he has some good ideas about the way the country really should be run.
Now, that's good analysis, but she's also a Trump supporter.
She's a Trump supporter. Mm-hmm. Even if that's a little bit surprising to you, she says that she and her friends are full of anger. And I'm going to play you also Abigail Dexter, another young voter, 23 from Concord. She is actually a little bit different, not for Trump. She's one of the people who doesn't appreciate Donald Trump's bombast. She is a Ted Cruz supporter. And the reason I'm playing you this audio is there is a race for second here in New Hampshire. Can Ted Cruz make a significant challenge to Marco Rubio for second place, which is going to be incredibly important? Listen to Abigail.
I'm just sick of people, establishment people. I'm sick of big business, and I'm sick of big government. And Ted Cruz, you can see by his record and what he stands for, that he is beholden to no one except the convictions of his heart, which are the Constitution.
So you've got two outlier GOP candidates in Trump and Cruz. That means it's going to be very, very hard for Marco Rubio to campaign as an outsider here since he's got so much mainstream endorsement.
The fascinating thing about New Hampshire is that Marco Rubio has sort of made himself the outsider because he's probably in third place. You say he has that establishment support, and he does. And that debate performance of the other night, which many New Hampshire voters saw, where Marco Rubio stumbled on his talking points and was attacked by one of his main antagonists, Chris Christie, was in some ways a potential disaster for the party because it elevated Donald Trump. It elevated Ted Cruz, the two people who the party desperately doesn't want to win and doesn't want to have momentum coming out of New Hampshire. So it's complicated in that way. Can Marco Rubio make a strong showing? He's not going to win in New Hampshire. Most likely Donald Trump has that double-digit lead. Can he make a strong second? He's really going to have to continue to make his case coming out of New Hampshire on Wednesday.
What about the battle of the governors? There hasn't been much talk about that, but that certainly was what the debate was all about.
And John Kasich has spent months and months and months reminding New Hampshire Republicans and independents that he spent months talking to them, 100 town halls. He wants them to remember how familiar John Kasich is, governor of Ohio, to them. And will it pay off? That's a big question. Chris Christie made the most of the night attacking Marco Rubio and has gotten the most headlines out of it. So that battle of governors really is a battle for second, really a battle for third. Will the party be able to coalesce behind a former executive instead of one of these senators?
Before we go, you've got to play this tape from Archie Richards, who's a legend there in New Hampshire.
John, I'll play you Archie Richards, who was outside of the debate the other night, who I ran into, who's a strong Cruz supporter, and he'll tell you why.
God almighty, why would I be for Trump? He's a jerk, and he's a liberal. Cruz is the most consistent conservative. The others, they waffle.
And from here on out, you're going to be looking at heroin in New Hampshire.
John, the heroin and opiate epidemic has devastated New Hampshire. I've been spending time with some families who've suffered from addiction, from brushes with the law and with overdose, to really take a look at what this race that's focusing on New Hampshire means for them after the politicians leave. That's coming up tomorrow.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the road in New Hampshire. Thanks, Todd.
You got it, John.
A town reportedly already reduced to rubble, erupting again, sending tens of thousands to flee the devastated city of Aleppo, where they are now held up at the Turkish border.
We have received already more than 5,000 of them. Another 55,000 of them are on the way.
The Turkish foreign minister there pleading for international help. His country is already home to 2.5 million refugees. Joining us now is Amberin Zaman, Turkish journalist and currently a public policy fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Amberin, welcome to The Takeaway. And I didn't know there were any people left in Aleppo. Does this surprise you, this number of refugees?
Well, actually, not at all, because Aleppo continued to be inhabited by a significant number of people. And as you know, the city has been divided between areas under government control and those under rebel control. And now those under rebel control are under assault by the regime, by the Syrian army. And you have tens of thousands of people now fleeing towards the Turkish border, waiting to be allowed in by the Turkish authorities, who so far, despite expressing a lot of sympathy for these people, not saying that they can come in yet.
I would think that the Turks have monitored this situation fairly closely in Aleppo and would have anticipated that sooner or later something like this was going to happen. Are they caught unawares here?
Well, yes and no. They have been saying for some time that a huge wave of refugees was likely to come towards Turkey if indeed the regime closed in on Aleppo, and they've been appealing to the international community to set up a safe zone along the border. They don't want those refugees to come inside Turkey because, as you pointed out, they already have 2.5 million Syrians inside Turkey. So what they wanted was for a safe zone to be created along the border where these refugees could stay and be safe. And at the same time, of course, for the rebels fighting Assad to also base themselves there and use this as some kind of a rear guard to continue with their campaign to topple Assad. But of course, that's not going very well. And there's absolutely no support for that idea of a free zone from the U.S. administration.
I mean, that would involve the U.S. actually taking territory with boots on the ground inside Syria to protect both the Turkish border and to protect the refugees. And that would be a serious escalation of U.S. involvement.
Absolutely. And let's not forget that Russia is now in the mix. And the last thing the United States wants is a confrontation with Russia.
So what happens to these people? These are 55,000 people in a state of complete limbo, and there's no incentive for Bashar al-Assad to do anything to help them.
Absolutely. They're kind of like sitting ducks at this point. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel is now in Ankara, Turkey, holding talks with the Turkish Prime Minister about refugees. You know that Europe is terribly concerned about these Syrians coming into Europe, and they've given Turkey about $3.3 billion so that they can keep them inside Turkey, making Turkey some kind of a holding pen, if you will, for these Syrian refugees so they don't come through to Europe. And so now you have even more Syrian refugees pressing against Turkey's borders. What do you do with these people? In the medium term, everybody recognizes that this is not a solution, that you need to solve this problem inside Syria, that you need to end the conflict inside Syria if you want this problem to go away. But as you know, the Geneva talks have not been going well, and the Russians seem to believe they can press their advantage and that they're on the winning side, that the regime is on the winning side, that Assad can stay.
Ambrin Zaman is a Turkish journalist and currently a public policy fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Ambrin.
Thank you.
Votes are in on the Takeaways quest to find America's greatest innovation. Round two begins today. We've narrowed the pool from 9 to 5, and here they are. In second place, a four-way tie, GPS, the cell phone, air conditioning, and the 3D printer. And in first place, the sewing machine. To vote for America's greatest innovation, please visit thetakeaway.org/innovation. Choose from our list or nominate your own. Many of you are still voting for the wildcard candidate. Number 10, not included in the 9 we've presented so far, can totally change the game. So stay with us. Will Gaza become the next battleground for ISIS, the home to nearly 2 million Palestinians and controlled by the Islamist Hamas organization, has been having trouble holding supporters in line. Gaza has become fertile recruiting ground for ISIS, and if another war breaks out between Israel and Gaza, Israel will be facing its own war on ISIS. Sarah Helm is a journalist covering the Middle East. She recently returned from Gaza, where the ISIS message, she finds, is increasingly persuasive.
In the eyes of young people in Gaza, those who see absolutely no hope for the future and who feel completely humiliated, these are stateless people without any chance of getting out, without any chance of real work, without any chance of, you know, leading a normal life. These kind of people, as elsewhere in the world, as in cities in Europe, in Britain, in France and so on, can be deluded into thinking that ISIS has answers. And the answers ISIS offers them, as indeed it offers to others it's trying to recruit, is of a caliphate. The Palestinians don't have a state. They now never think they will have a state. So they think, well, perhaps the caliphate will come quicker than the state. And it also offers them a certain amount of glamour. So they think it's more glamorous to fight with these warriors of ISIS. They think that, you know, there'll be rewards in heaven, and all these kind of elements seem more enticing than any other form of sort of land-bound politician can offer them.
It's also a strange lesson of history that's relatively unexpected, in that at one time, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, was at the center of all Middle East politics. And ISIS would have us believe that, no, the Palestinian conflict is a sideshow, and in fact, that's something that they criticize Hamas for.
There is a strain of thought that thinks that they are deliberately leaving Israel-Palestine off their agenda at the moment because they can't fight on two fronts, and they don't want to take on that extraordinarily difficult issue of Israel-Palestine at the moment. So they're not getting directly involved. It's also true to say it's much more difficult for them to get directly involved, because it's very difficult, of course, for ISIS to infiltrate in and out of the West Bank and Gaza, and indeed Israel proper.
Based on your experience inside the besieged Gaza, how much of a profile is there of ISIS or Daesh? I mean, is it spoken about? Is there evidence on the street of ISIS's presence or attempt to raise its profile?
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating. It's the most extraordinary situation. I first went there immediately after the war of 2014, when more than 2,000 Palestinians were killed and the place was destroyed and devastated by bombing. And I began to hear talk of Daesh there in very small ways, in ways that most of the Gazans were not too concerned about. They'd just seen people dressed in what they call Pakistani garb, in other words, that kind of particular traditional garb that many of the ISIS Salafists, as they call themselves, are dressed. But nobody was too worried at that time. But gradually, over the course of the last sort of 18 months or so, there has been more of that. There have been bombings inside Gaza. The French Cultural Centre there was attacked twice. ISIS the ISIS supporters, I should say, in Gaza openly avowed that they'd done that. There was graffiti left on the walls, and there was a small demonstration and so on. And I myself saw a sight which astonished me, as somebody who's been going to Gaza for, you know, 25 years. On a beach in Rafah, I saw a group of Salafists, other religious extremists where the support is strongest, walking down the beach, dressed in very traditional white robes with the long beards, etc., carrying a banner telling women to cover up immediately and men not to look at women, and with other sort of pronouncements like that, in really quite a threatening way. And also shops that are selling women's swimming costumes or women's clothes that is deemed to be immodest, they have to take the heads off the mannequins. So there's a sort of, it happens at many levels. There's a sort of increasing fear of the extremist religious clampdown. There's a physical presence. There's military presence, as evidence of violence, of small bomb attacks and attacks on Hamas. It's difficult to say exactly how substantial it is, but there's a sense that if things went really badly wrong, for example, if there was another major rise in tension and in the conflict with Israel, that the ISIS supporting groups would grow in strength. And the other thing to add is that, as people say, one of the most worrying things is that a lot of their strength and their military expertise is coming from the Al-Qassam people themselves. This is the military wing of Hamas. And many of these men are angry that Hamas has been too moderate and has been negotiating the ceasefire with Israel. And they want much more action, much more military resistance to Israel. And they are defecting from Hamas, from Al-Qassam, and lending their support to these ISIS groups. That is potentially the most worrying development.
Sarah Helm recently returned from Gaza. You can read her report on ISIS in Gaza and its potential for future conflict in the region in the New York Review of Books. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A power shift in Haiti. A president steps down to be replaced by citizen anger. Anti-government demonstrations in Port-au-Prince following the resignation of President Michel Martelly. Martelly could not survive the questions about widely discredited election results in October and his handling of two runoffs that have been canceled. But no election until April 24th leaves a political void. Joining us is Jacqueline Charles, Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, is this a transfer of power or a coup d'etat?
Well, it's neither, actually. It is a provisional government that is supposed to last for 120 days in order for there to be the elections for the president and for a small number of parliamentarians, I think about 26. So I think today, when you're looking at Haiti, it is a period of political uncertainty. The next couple of days hopefully will bring some clarity, but the crisis may get deeper. But the idea is getting out of this, being able to go into a runoff election, either with these two candidates or either with another candidate or some sort of political compromise, so that by May 14th, there is a new elected president who is taking office and then can start to deal with the real issues that are affecting the people in the country. And there are some real issues. There's drought, there's hunger, there's devaluation of the local currency, there's slowdown in growth. I mean, there is, you know, the one thing that the place has been blessed with in the last 5 years is that it has not been hit by a major disaster. There wasn't another earthquake, and there certainly were no hurricanes, which we have seen in the past. But the other social challenges, the economic challenges, they remain and they are real.
So the experiment with a celebrity president is over for the time being. Are the new candidates closer to the traditional parties, which are associated with the brutality of regimes that go back decades?
No. What you have, if we take the two candidates that qualify for the runoff, the one is Jovenel Moïse, and Jovenel Moïse is the handpicked successor of President Michel Martelly. And this is what created the problems to begin with. He is a virtually unknown. And when I say unknown, if you were to talk to several people in President Martelly's entourage, if they had ever met Jovenel Moïse, they would have told you no, that they had not met him prior to President Martelly naming him, and even early on. So in 3 months, President Martelly presented someone, put him on the campaign trail, and the elections are held, and he comes out on top. So this in and of itself made people very suspicious. On top of, there were other issues in terms of 900,000 accreditation cards that were given to poll workers and observers, and they were allowed to vote with these without voter ID sometimes, and people voted multiple times. So that became very messy. The second candidate is Jules Celestin, the mechanical engineer, the former head of the state construction agency. After the earthquake, it was his team that went around the Capitol and were picking up the bodies, and they buried the earthquake dead, more than 200,000. So he comes into this having worked in government, having some a track record. He is not necessarily a leftist. He's probably more center-left, if you want to call it that way. But when you look at his team, he has people from all of the ideologies that have been involved in Haiti over the years. But he's a very modern, you know, a modern guy in his, you know, in his thinking.
Haiti at a crossroads, to be sure. We will be following this in the next couple of weeks. Jacqueline Charles is a Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Over the weekend, North Korea launched what it calls an Earth observation satellite, what the rest of the world sees as the country's first step in designing a long-range missile system. The United Nations condemned the launch, and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, promised that there would be consequences.
Because of the DPRK's decisions and actions, we will ensure that the Security Council imposes serious consequences.
Consequences, they say, in the UN? David Sanger, national security correspondent for our part in the New York Times. What do we think Kim Jong-un hears when the UN says consequences?
I think mostly he hears more of the same. Look, the United States has been putting sanctions on North Korea since the Korean War ended in 1953. And if President Obama leaves office January 20th of next year with Kim Jong-un, the grandson of the founder of the country, still in office, there will have been a dozen presidents of the United States who would have put sanctions on the Kim family in various forms, and they're still standing.
So is there any particular sanction that would relate to this missile program? Could there be control of airspace or anything like that that would relate specifically to this tactic?
The big sanctions so far, John, have been focused on the nuclear test, which was conducted last month, which the North Koreans claimed to be a hydrogen bomb and didn't look like it was a hydrogen bomb, just didn't seem as if it was of the scale necessary to prove that case. And ever since that explosion took place, the U.S. and China have been engaged in a behind-the-scenes arm wrestle over just how severe the sanctions would be. The Chinese want the sanctions limited, as they have in the past, to some individuals who are responsible for the nuclear or missile programs. The U.S. wants much broader sanctions that would cause real economic pain. The Chinese fear, of course, is that real economic pain could lead to a North Korean collapse. They'd get the refugees and they'd get South Korean and perhaps American forces up on their border. They have no interest in that.
So that's interesting. So the Chinese have actually fingered individuals within the North Korean hierarchy that they suggest that the U.S. actually freeze assets of, and the U.S. is saying, no, 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 we want to do something else?
The U.S. has long known the names of individuals and of individual companies that are suppliers to these. There are a lot of U.S. sanctions against those already, and it's very similar to where the U.S. and the rest of the world was in sanctioning Iran a decade ago. But in the end, the sanctions that made a difference in the Iran case were sanctions that really cut off their oil revenues or cut them down a lot, made it extremely difficult for them to do any financial services around the world. It's already very difficult for North Korea to do that. Part of the problem here, John, is North Korea is one of the most sanctioned countries on earth. So doing additional sanctions frequently is something that they can barely feel. Remember, it was a year ago that President Obama put some additional U.S. sanctions on North Korea in response to the hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment. And I found no evidence that those were anything that the North Koreans actually felt.
Did you hear the GOP debate over the weekend, talk of preemptive strikes and anti-missile systems directed at North Korea? Does that make that rhetoric more plausible?
Well, certainly on the anti-missile system, they're a little behind President Obama here, who has been trying to convince the South Koreans for several years to put in a new ABM system called the THAAD system that intercepts missiles up in the outer atmosphere instead of being focused on missiles that stay inside the atmosphere. So it's focused on the ballistic problem. And the South Koreans have resisted that for fear of angering China. The Chinese think this is directed at them. And so, so far, the South Koreans haven't agreed. President Obama suggested in an interview before the Super Bowl last night that that discussion is now revived.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Great to be back with you.
For the diehard NFL fans, football does not have to end.
An entire season of work, and it looks like Super Bowl 50 will come down to this play. Touchdown! Touchdown! What a huge play! The Carolina Panthers have won the Super Bowl.
Men can continue to bash into each other endlessly in the virtual Madden NFL 16 Super Bowl-themed video game, which regularly sells in the two or three top game titles. Call of Duty Black Ops 3 dominates the video game market, selling more than 250 million copies in an industry that has racked up $13 billion in sales, largely for violent point-and-shoot combat games. Or life run amok testosterone-driven simulations like Grand Theft Auto 1 through 5. 6 is on hold, which may be a sign of a problem. The University of Southern California Game Design Graduate Program thinks the industry could benefit from an alternative approach to gaming. Women now outnumber men at both the graduate and undergraduate level at USC. Tracy Fullerton is a professor and director of the USC Games Program. She says the concept is getting back to the roots of gaming in America.
You know, if you look back to the earliest days of games, they were marketed to the entire family.
Right.
And there really wasn't a distinction. There wasn't any sense that there was one segment of the market that was going to like computer games more than another. This notion that we have that games are only for young men really evolved, to try to capitalize on a particular segment of the market.
So when you get into an academic setting like the University of Southern California's graduate video game design program, you notice that there are more women than men in the program. What does that mean? What kinds of ideas come to the table, or what kind of ideas stay at the table that might not have in the past?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that we didn't just notice it. We actually worked very hard to get to a place where we had, gender parity. So when we first began the program, just over a decade ago, it was attractive mostly to young men who wanted to get into the games industry. And we wanted to train creative thought leaders, people who were going to not just go into the industry and get a job, be what I call butts in seats, but to really think about the future of the entertainment industry and how interactivity and play fit into it and be these team leaders and thought leaders. And so, we knew we had to change the culture in order to do that. And one way to really change culture to make these kinds of differences in the industry was to have a more diverse group of people in the production team. So it was important to us from the outset to really build a place where it was inclusive, where we were talking about process, where we were thinking about what does it mean to have an inclusive work environment? What does it mean to be welcoming and to listen to diverse voices? So it was something that we worked very hard to build, and I'm really gratified to see so many talented young women want to come to our program to participate in that kind of environment.
What do you think the Call of Duty phenomenon is about? I sometimes think that it's a way in which individuals who maybe didn't go to Iraq or Afghanistan want to have that experience as a kind of surrogate experience, or it's a yearning to replay that experience with a different outcome.
There are people who believe that in our culture where men are expected to behave a certain way and there's not a lot of outlets for a certain type of aggression and competition, that these kinds of games actually provide that they provide that outlet. And I think that's one answer. I also think that it captures the imagination, right? And if your friends are playing something, you want to play it too because it allows for that group experience. I mean, look at how the entire nation has been just captured by Star Wars again. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? It is a positive feedback cycle. The more people who are captured by it, the more others are captured by it. And I think that there's something similar going on here with games, especially with games where there's a lot of multiplayer play. So you want to play the same games that everybody's playing because it's more fun to play the same games. If you want to play a multiplayer game, you don't want to play a game that nobody's playing because that wouldn't be any fun.
What multiplayer game most fascinated you when the capability suddenly allowed for hundreds of people to be playing simultaneously?
Well, I'll tell you honestly, I got really sucked into Halo. And
really?
I had a Halo clan for some time. We would meet every night in what we called the backyard, which is the Beaver Creek map for those who played. And a lot of it was these were my college friends and we were connecting. We'd all move to other places of the country and we could connect every night and play in these familiar spaces and you could talk to one another. It was better than a phone call. It was just good rough and tumble play with people you really liked.
And what about the development of virtual reality technology? Does this lead us to Walden, a game?
So it's interesting. So I started working on Walden about 8 years ago. And the core idea of this is that you would play Henry David Thoreau and you sort of follow in his footsteps.
When I first took up my abode in the woods, my house was not finished. It was a pleasant hillside where I worked, covered with pine woods, through which I looked out on the pond and a small open field in the woods where pines and hickories were springing up.
So in literary terms, this is very authentic. How do you think having a largely female, much more inclusive, collaborative team looking at the industry of gaming, how much does that open the possibility of bringing new people into the gaming experience?
For me, that's the bottom line. If you have a more diverse team and you have a respectful process that's listening to all the voices, then you're going to reflect a more diverse viewpoint. Your media is going to be attractive to a larger, wider public. So, you know, to me, that's part of the core of our entire program, is that if we can make that change in our program, then that change can go out from where we are into the industry. And I hope it will help the industry to take its next step towards taking its place alongside the broader industries that serve the entire public.
Tracy Fullerton, thanks so much for talking with me.
Sure thing.
Tracy Fullerton is a game designer and professor and director of the USC Games Program. A story now of how music became a companion of someone who needed a friend a few decades back and found a whole bunch of friends in his embrace of soul music. They helped him confront a number of important milestones in his life. Some of you have had the same kind of experiences.
This is Howard from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Temptations, Runaway Child. Where it says, you better go back home where you belong. Applied to me, I was thinking about running away when I was 13. But I thought, no, I better not.
Rashad Olison is a music critic and author of the new book Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl. It's a playful, emotional story of how songs can signify so much in their timing and lyrics, and how the music itself continues to speak to him from the moment his father first turned him on to vinyl records a long time ago.
Well, my father, who was a disturbed Vietnam vet, and had been addicted to drugs most of his life after coming back. And he was the one who had fostered my love for music. He would take me to the record shops and buy these used records and staple singers, Aretha Franklin, Bobby Womack, all this stuff. And this is the early 80s, so this is the age of MTV and Lionel Richie and Prince. And he's buying me all this stuff, all this old soul. He would always say, this is music you need to know. And so when he left the family with my parents' divorce, I just gravitated toward those records because I thought that they would sort of give me a window into him. I ended up finding myself in that music.
So when you would hum or hear Aretha Franklin do Soul Serenade, it was like putting on armor.
Yes, absolutely.
When you're not around, there's a lonely sound in my soul serenade.
You know, I felt if she could sing with that much strength and that much command and presence, that I could embody that some way.
And what were you fighting at the time?
Looking back, depression. My folks were, you know, in a very bitter divorce, and we moved around a lot, and I was very, very lonely. I was fighting that loneliness, that sadness that was always sort of hanging around like a big old cloud over my head.
You found yourself interested in Joni Mitchell's version of Black Crow.
Mm-hmm. I've always been drawn to imagery of flight, you know, in literature and in music. And that song embodies it, wanting to escape and wanting to be free and sort of charting your own destiny.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged, tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on some
And everything about that song, the layered guitars and the bass line, everything is beautiful about that record.
And ooh, sometimes temptation is just a little too much.
Bobby Womack put something down on it. Is it the music and the statement of the sound that means the most to you, or is it something about the message?
With that particular Bobby Womack song, I think I relate to it more now as an adult. If you want this love I'm giving, you need to put something down on it. Spend a little time on it, you know, which is just some good old-fashioned common sense. A relationship takes time. It takes you being there. And that's what that... He always... you know, sort of put it out there like he was sitting in a pool hall talking to you directly about the philosophy of love and being with somebody. And he just broke it down in language that was as earthy as collard greens. Put some down on it.
Put some down on it. Trying to carry it further. Minnie Riperton? Inside My Love?
Yeah. That record I heard for the first time when I was 14. And I was able to engage that lyric right away, this love that is beyond carnal. It's carnal and spiritual. And it's one of those gorgeous songs that even when it gets to the chorus and the strings swell, there's just something about it that makes me feel like I'm levitating or something.
What was your image of love?
I mean, it's changed since then, but I had a very romanticized image of love, which most teenagers do, but I thought that it would feel like those songs felt, that it would feel like I'm flying. It would feel all sweet and romantic. And I believe that it's much more than just feeling like, you know, you're flying, you know, but I think it's still nice to have that feeling that you're connected with someone, and it is a sweet thing until it becomes something deeper and it opens you up and challenges you to be more than you think you could be.
Was your dad right with these songs? The songs that he would pick out for you, that you needed to hear these songs?
I think so. I felt closer to him. In my family, music was like another relative. You know, people talked about these artists as though they were kin to us. You know, so we had this very close connection to music that spoke to us on a deeper level. It spoke to our aspirations. It spoke to what we wanted to be and who we thought we were, providing solace, comfort, laughter, escape. It was everything to us. Looking out across the night, the city winks asleep as I hear her voice shake my window.
You chose a Michael Jackson tune here,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the odd duck on Thriller.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's the melody that draws me, but it's also something about the way Michael sings that song that conveys a sense of yearning. If they say why, tell them that it's human. That could be sexual, it could be spiritual. You know, there's a lot that you can fold into that song.
Well, we've talked about five great tracks. Mm-hmm. You want to pick something else to take us out on?
You know, I mentioned Chaka Khan because Chaka Khan. You know, when I was being bullied in school, it was her voice sounds like defiance to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Aretha was ingratiating and so was Chaka in a way, but Chaka had another edge. I think if there's a song that I would add to this list is her song with Rufus from 1974, Once You Get Started. Once you get started, oh, it's hard to stop. It's a party jam, but my favorite part of that song is the beginning. The horns are blaring and she's screaming over the horns. It's just this announcement, I am here, get out of my way. You know, you're not going to run me over. There's something when she sings that lets you know I'm always here.
Well, we'll get out of the way. Rashad Ollison is a music critic and author of the new book, Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Jessica from Austin, Texas. And the line
Thunder only happens when it's raining, and Players Only Love You When They're Playing, from Fleetwood Mac's Dreams from 1977, brings back vivid, painful memories of the time when my mother and father were getting divorced.
React to anything you hear on the program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and I do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your questions again. Tweet your questions to me at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. And from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.